Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The Pittsburgh Steelers played the Miami Dolphins last night. The Pittsburgh Steelers beat the Miami Dolphins last night. Now, I could come in here and it would be very easy to clown the Dolphins for being 0-7, for blowing a 14-point lead. Or I could even praise them for coming out and jumping out to that 14-point lead on the road and showing some fight. But a lack of fight has not been the problem with the Dolphins. The coaching staff, the players, they're trying to win games. They just don't have the talent to win games. It's not even their fault. It's not like the coaches are setting out to intentionally lose games. At least, that's what I thought until I saw one play last night. I would have given Miami the benefit of the doubt until this one play last night. Miami up 14-3. Less than a minute to go in the first half. Pittsburgh has the ball. They're facing 3rd and 20. 3rd and 20 from the Miami 45. So let me take a quick moment here to point out that Pittsburgh had the ball in that spot because Ryan Fitzpatrick was picked off by former teammate Minka Fitzpatrick. But I digress. There are a lot of defensive play calls that you can make in this situation. The Dolphins call a timeout to make sure they got the right call, and they end up going with this.
Moving left to right, looking into six Miami defensive backs. No one's got their hand in the grass. They all cut. They rush seven. Here goes Rudolph, line drive pass. It's a slant at the 40. It's caught by Deontay Johnson, the 30, and the numbers, the 20. Got a block at the 15. Breaks a tackle at the 10. Cuts to his right, into the end zone. Touchdown, Pittsburgh. What a play! Deontay Johnson, a 45-yard Steeler touchdown pass. With 17 seconds to play in the first half, they brought the house and they paid dearly for it.
That's absolutely what happened. That's Westwood One, and they did bring the house and they did pay for it. I'm just one play away from forcing a punt and a few seconds away from going into halftime with a 14-3 lead. Miami, though, goes with a cover zero blitz on 3rd and 20. A cover zero blitz. I don't think I need to get up to the chalkboard to tell you what that looks like. It looks like 8 guys rushing the quarterback and 3 guys in coverage. And shocker, those 8 guys did not get home. But Steelers wide receiver Deontay Johnson did. There was not anybody within 15 yards of this guy when he caught that pass and then made his way into the end zone to make it 14-10. An all-time horrible defensive play call. I mean, I'm not going to say that the moment changed the outcome of the game because Miami was going to lose that game no matter what. It was only a matter of how and by how much. But that sure as hell did change the momentum going into halftime. And that was an all-time horrible defensive play call. And if you think Dolphins head coach Brian Flores is going to second-guess that call, well, think again.
I don't have any regrets on the call. I want to be aggressive. I mean, we can second-guess a lot of calls, and I'm not going to second-guess that one.
Listen, this guy, Flores, he's in an impossible situation. He's trying to coach a team that's been stripped of its talent. So I'm not going to second guess that call. Yes, I am. I'm going to second guess it, third guess it, first guess it. Second guessing would imply that I'm questioning it after the fact. But really, I questioned it the second I saw that thing play out. I mean, I'm all for being aggressive. But given the talent they have, and the situation they found themselves in, that is an all-time terrible call. You would have been better off calling punt block, because at least there'd be a guy back to play deep. And the momentum completely swung towards Pittsburgh after that play. And if you didn't know the Steelers were going to win then, you certainly knew it in the second half, because the Dolphins could not keep control of the ball. Hey, Minka, have another one.
Drops back deep, winds up, long arching spiral down the middle, and it is intercepted on a leaping dive at the 5 by Minka Fitzpatrick. At the Pittsburgh 5, Fitzpatrick has just picked off Fitzpatrick for a second time tonight.
All right, then. How about this? I mean, this looks like this might be a nice play for the Dolphins. No, it's not.
In the gun, Fitzpatrick, high snap, pulls it down, moves up, avoids the rush, on the move, throws a short pass right in front of him, caught by Walton at the 45, got a block at the 40, fumbled the ball, it's rolling past the 30, it's rolling past the 27, it's down to the 26, and there's a big scrum, and it looks like Pittsburgh has gotten the fumble of the Miami Dolphins, Miami's third turnover tonight.
And it seemed like every single time Ryan Fitzpatrick dropped back to pass, TJ Watt was in his beard. Like this time.
Fitzpatrick with a couple of touchdowns, couple of picks, drops back in the gun, gets a block. He's hit. TJ Watt devours him. He's sacked back at the 22-yard line. Watt may have taken the ball away. He comes out of the pile. He ripped the ball away from Fitzpatrick. It is a fumble, and Pittsburgh has gotten it.
So TJ Watt was doing things like that, and he was doing things like this.
Big rush. Fitzpatrick out of the pocket. The ball comes out.
And Mike Dieter. Mike Dieter had it, and now it's... Mike Dieter.
It's been whistled dead.
Mike Dieter.
Steelers radio. So at that point, I just felt badly for Ryan Fitzpatrick. I mean, don't get me wrong. He seems to have a pretty good thing going. He's got a lot of kids. He's got a huge beard. Oh, and did you know he went to Harvard? But he was getting so overpowered by TJ Watt and fumbling the ball all over the place that it got to be tough and painful to watch. And speaking of tough and painful to watch, how about the fact that we've made it this far in talking about last night's game and we have not talked about the officiating yet? Now, that's not because the officiating was good. It wasn't. It was terrible. Again. And it really is leaving a mark on the game. Maybe you can get away with bad officiating on a Sunday when everybody is watching different games, but on Monday night, you can't because everybody's watching the same game in prime time, even that terrible game. But the one thing you can't have on a Monday night is a 10-minute review. A 10-minute review in a game that horrible, no less. But that's exactly what happened. The officials had that in the third quarter, 4th and 1. Fitzpatrick tried to scramble for a first down, and the officials gave it to him. The Steelers challenge, okay, that's fine, they should. And on review, Fitzpatrick was ruled to be down short of the first down line. Steelers ball, awesome. And then the chain gang came out, because you know it's 2019. There's no better way to measure the placement of a football than a crew of people with a couple of sticks and a bunch of chain. But you want to talk about the exact science. I got to be honest. I've never really understood this. You talk about moving the game ahead to 2019. They're still measuring for first downs with a couple of old guys and sticks and a bike chain. In the meantime, the review continues. The perform continues. And when it was all said and done, finally, after nearly 10 minutes, we find out whether or not a guy got to the first down marker. But let's be clear about one thing. That is not a 10-minute review. That is a 10-minute delay in a game that nobody wanted to see in the first place. It's almost a whole nother halftime. You do that, and you better roll out Up With People to provide some entertainment. Get me my Up With People. Or even worse, get me Coldplay. If you need 10 minutes to review something and check it, you're in way over your head. Seriously. And the worst part of that review is knowing that the league does not really seem to have any problem with it. Like, officiating has been a complete disaster all year long, and you've got guys like Jerry Jones saying, well, as long as people are talking about us, that's a good thing. The hell it is.
As long as they're talking, keep it going.
The hell it is. It's a terrible thing. And the only thing worse than having to watch an 0-6 Dolphins team on a Monday night is having to sit through a 10-minute delay while the officials do their jobs. Now Miami is 0-7, but at least they say they've got a plan for getting better. The NFL refs are 0 for everything, and the league is cool with it. And there's no reason to believe that that's going to change or improve anytime soon. The NFL needs to follow suit with Major League Baseball and just bring on the robots. Robots have no trouble making up their minds. A 10-minute delay in that game to determine whether or not the ball advanced to the first down marker. Something that's normally determined by a couple of old dudes and a couple of sticks and a rusted bike chain. Man. Like I said, Ryan Fitzpatrick, although winless, still has a pretty good thing going, right? He's got a lot of kids. He's got an awesome beard. Pay ain't bad. Oh, did you know he went to Harvard? He says they're not giving in.
We just got to continue to keep fighting. And that's just kind of the place that we're at right now. Just continue to keep fighting, continue to, you know, keep going to practice and trying to get better every single day. And then making sure that when we come out on Monday night or on Sundays now, we just out here and enjoying each other and trying to have fun out on the field.
Improve visibility and save money at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Stop by for their See Better, Drive Safer sale where you can earn a $15 gift card after mail-in rebate when you purchase either Sylvania headlight bulbs or Bosch Focus or Trico Titan wiper blades. They'll even install your wiper blades for free while you wait. Don't risk your safety because of poor visibility. Let the professional parts people at O'Reilly help you find just what you need. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Richard Yergin is my guest. Richard, great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Good, man. Good. Listen, you have an amazing story, which I want to get to and share with everybody because truly it is inspiring. But let's start first with last week ahead of that game against Clemson. Is it true that you received a message on the Cash App from a former Clemson teammate looking to charge you a dollar to enter Death Valley for the game? And if so, what was your reaction when you saw that?
It was just a running joke, you know, just kind of one of those things where – you know, you see it and you're like, are you serious? But at the end of the day, you know, just a little, make the competition a little bit better, you know?
That is funny. Now, I would say the last week was really significant for you, but really every single week has been really significant. Just so people can really understand everything you've overcome. You were an elite player coming out of high school. So what was it about Clemson that made you feel like that was the place where you wanted to go play and go to school?
Well, you know, at the time, Clemson was a program that was kind of on the rise of becoming a national, you know, contender. And so my class of 2014 was, you know, the inaugural class of, you know, once we got there, you know, we went through that season, another 10-win season, and a majority of us redshirted that year. And in 2015 is kind of when we started to begin to, you know, do the whole Alabama-Clemson thing every year in the national title game or, you know, in the CFP or, you know, whatever the case may be. So I would honestly say, you know, it was the program, the foundation was laid out in 2009, you know, with former players like C.J. Spillers of the world, Taj Boyes, and, you know, my class, you know, we came in combination with, you know, other guys that were there, and, you know, we tried to elevate it and just take the program to another level. And under the leadership of Coach Sweeney, you know, he was a great coach. He had a great vision, a great plan, and, you know, we just tried to follow suit with that.
Richard Yergin is joining us. You know, you were part of that great recruiting class. You had guys like Vic Beasley Jr., Shaq Lawson. You had to battle them for playing time. In fact, at that time, you had to be patient. What was that experience like for you?
Honestly, I would say during that time frame, you know, being a young guy, you want to learn how to not just solely depend on your athletic ability and, you know, become more of a student of the game. So just being able to study up under those guys and, you know, take advice and, you know, just kind of build up towards my game because clearly, you know, you think that you got it all figured out when you come out of high school just because you were ranked high and all of this stuff, but, you know, you still need to develop mentally, physically, and all of that stuff. So I just had to be willing to be humble and just address the things that I needed to get better at, to fix. And, you know, I was willing to do that. And, you know, that put me in a good position, you know, obviously prior to the accident.
All right. So in 2017, you guys win the national championship. What do you remember most about that team and that experience?
Honestly, during that time, our defensive line, we were young. A lot of us, me, Cleveland Farrell, Austin Bryant, you know, Dexter Lawrence at the time, Christian Wilkins, Albert Huggins, Chris Register, a lot of guys, we were young guys and, you know, we were trying to prove ourselves week in and week out. And, you know, we had some veterans on the offense, which was a great thing, you know, and defensively we felt like we kind of had a chip on our shoulder. And so for me, you know, as a player, I wanted to challenge myself to, you know, although I was considered a young player at the time, you know, play up to the level of an older player, you know, like I'd learned from Vic Beasley, Shaq Lawson's of the world. And, you know, the rest of us, we just took it personal and we wanted to kind of leave a mark on that season. And so, you know, the separation was in the preparation and, you know, we were under a good coach at the time, Coach Hobby. And Coach Dan Brooks, and, you know, they helped develop us at the time, and, you know, we just kept getting better week in and week out.
Richard Yergin is joining us. He's a D lineman with Boston College. Richard, you mentioned the accident. As Dabo Sweeney has said, you were getting ready to be, quote, the guy for Clemson. Quote, he had a good year, was gaining confidence. He had a great spring. End quote. Then in June of that summer, you were driving on a rainy day. You had to slam on the brakes. The wheels locked. The car skidded. I want to be really careful and really sensitive about this, but what do you remember next?
You know, from that moment on, things was a blur in terms of, you know, what exactly transpired in that moment. But like I said, I vaguely remember, you know, just being in a situation where I no longer had control of the wheel. And it may sound cliche, but at the time, when I think back on it now, you know, God took control of the wheel. And typically in a situation that I was in, anyone that, you know, does not have the physical fortitude or, you know, build or whatever or makeup would typically be paralyzed or, you know, deceased. And so for me, all I know is in that moment, everything that happened, I walked out with no scratches, a concussion, and just a broken neck. I know it sounds like, oh, okay, well, that's a lot. But in my eyes, you know, I was like, okay, well, I realized it could have been much worse than what it actually ended up being. So I'll take the lighter side of, you know, what it could have actually been and just accept that. And, you know, having to kind of just fight through that process, you know, just happy that I made it out of that car and, you know, woke up in the hospital like, okay, you know, what just happened? And, you know, just having to deal with, you know, trying to be able to walk after 3 days and be able to just move around normally just gives you a whole lot of perspective at a young age. And, you know, I honestly, that's the best I can do with answering that question.
No, in fact, you did amazingly well in answering the question, because the fact of the matter is you're in this wreck and you suffer a broken neck, you suffer a concussion, you broke some other bones, and doctors did in fact say that most people would not survive an accident like that, and those who do are generally paralyzed. So you eventually leave the hospital, and then you have to spend 3 months of bed rest at home. At that point, I'm curious, what kind of thoughts were you having about football? Was it something that you ever wanted to do again, or were you simply trying to make it through every day?
Initially, I was just taking it one day at a time. Obviously, it's hard to put yourself ahead of your process that you're going through and kind of see the forest before the trees. But eventually, I would say during probably month two, you know, after, you know, sitting there every day, reading, writing, playing video games, and, you know, just kind of reminiscing and reflecting, you just kind of get into that mindset where it's like, okay, this is where I'm at now, and how do we move forward from here? And so, you know, I think that it was a very challenging but also rewarding process from the human nature side of it. It challenged me to get outside of my comfort zone, deal with a different set of adversity that, you know, typically you don't want to go through. You know, no one ever wishes, you know, when you tell someone, hey, you know, don't break your neck, you know, to literally go break your neck.
And, right.
You know, obviously that happened to me. So, you know, what do? You have to address it and deal with it, the emotions that come with that, the physical pain. And then you figure out, how do I move past this? And so I would say, you know, at that month and a half mark, you know, I was able to then kind of, with the help of my family and my brother and, you know, support staff at Clemson and friends, and, you know, my girlfriend at the time, you know, just be able to kind of move past a lot of that stuff.
All right, so there's still so much more to the story. Richard Yerrigan joining us, and we don't have time to tell the entire story, but the fact is you were clear to play football the following summer, and in August 2018 you were back at practice but didn't feel like yourself entirely. Doctors suggested you have another surgery on your neck, something like Peyton Manning had, but that would mean another year of rehab, and it could be the end of football for you. So what kind of conversations did you have with your family about that and the decision you had to make?
Yeah. My family was in total support of me just being able to live a normal, comfortable life. So they didn't want to make me feel like having the surgery was the end of the world. But at the end of the day, you know, if I was then to have to move on from football, how to deal with that process, you know, we talked through some options and some things that, you know, may have been, you know, usable at the time for me to just kind of think, okay, if I'm really going to be done with football from a playing standpoint, then maybe I can use football to say I want to coach or you know, I want a mentor, and, you know, I'm like I said, I'm going to finish out my master's degree in athletic leadership for sure and have that in the bank, you know, and just different options that I had on the table at the time, and not to kind of like, you know, make it all about football's coming to an end, so now my world's coming to an end. There's so many more things that I can, you know, hold on to and grasp other than just, you know, being out there on the field on Saturday. And that kind of gave me peace of mind at the time that, you know, if I was to then not be able to step back on the field, at least I know that I utilized football, like I said, with all the usable options that I had on the table.
All right. So you set the entire thing up, and these were all options for you, all great options, but you meet with the surgeon, and the surgeon tells you you can, in fact, play football again if you wanted to. You put your name into the transfer portal. Boston College reaches out to you. What was that moment like?
Honestly, it was a moment of clarity because, as I alluded to before in another interview, I had recently lost my grandmother, and, you know, it was kind of a hard time for my family and I, and obviously I just had a son, and, you know, I was thinking about, you know, potentially, okay, now I have to provide for, you know, my family and things of that nature, so maybe it's time to kind of think about, you know, testing the job market and, you know, different options that just come at you in life. And one night, I don't remember exactly which night it was, I had a dream that I'd spoken with Coach Sweeney, and somehow we were talking about, well, you know, Coach, I think I want to play football again, and the dream just kind of just cut off right there. And I was like, well, that didn't make sense, you know, like why would I have a dream like that, especially in this time of kind of like chaos. And so, you know, I didn't think much of it, you know, at the time. And as, you know, a week or two went by, and, you know, I go and visit with the doctor, and, you know, he gives me that set of news. Obviously, I wasn't, you know, nowhere near where I should be in terms of a mental toughness standpoint of getting ready to go play football. So I kind of had to regenerate my mindset. You know, physically, I was still in it, you know, and all of that, working out every day, that sort of thing, but just didn't have that purpose that I, you know, normally would have, because you're just trying to figure so many different things out and so much is coming at you. So I had to take time to decompartmentalize all my thoughts and figure out, okay, again, this is where I'm at right now. You know, all that I've been through has been preparing me for this moment of clarity. And now that, you know, opportunity presents itself, I need to address it with the mindset that I'm going to go and take what's mine. And so, again, like I said, you know, it was such a surreal moment, and I couldn't have been more thankful for Boston College, you know, being a, you know, university built off of the principles and the values that they pride themselves on, to then provide me that sense of clarity from having faith in that someone would, you know, give me another opportunity to play ball again.
Absolutely incredible. I got about 1 minute left. In terms of refining that purpose, how much does your son Elijah factor into this?
Honestly, he's my world. I've spent almost every day with him since he was born, obviously up until the time where I departed for you know, Boston College, and, you know, he's back home with my parents and my now fiance, and, you know, I couldn't fathom being away from him. And not be working towards my purpose, and, you know, not be focused on what it is that I'm trying to accomplish, because, you know, then I would be cheating him. So, you know, right now my mindset is to, you know, complete the task at hand and to give him a better life than, you know, anyone in my family has ever had. And you know, right now, for me, the way that I'm doing that is, you know, continuing to pursue more education and give my all for this university, and just show the world, you know, what you can really do if you put your mind to it, and you know, just have the right perspective about, you know, second opportunities in life and how you prepare for them, and, you know, turning trials and tribulations into triumph.
All right, so let's talk about a common problem for a minute. The one thing that health experts, dietitians, athletes, and top performers all seem to agree on is the perfect diet does not exist. Even with a balanced, healthy diet, it can be tough to cover your nutritional bases through food alone. This is why there is Athletic Greens. The Athletic Greens Ultimate Daily All-in-One Health Drink has 75 proven vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced ingredients, which make it easier for you to get that comprehensive nutrition without the need for multiple pills, powders, or complex routines. It is the most complete supplement for a better you. And it's different from everything else. It's different because it's delivered in powder form and mixed with water. Athletic Greens then requires less capsules. It has superior absorption and does not include any binders or fillers. As your body's daily nutritional needs change due to stress, travel, sleep patterns, the environment, and more, one scoop of Athletic Greens provides a convenient, affordable, and tasty solution to fill the gaps in your diet. So if you're looking to boost energy, strengthen your immune system, or support gut health, this is the product for you. Even if you're an athlete or a professional seeking enhanced performance, maybe you travel frequently and you struggle to maintain your routine on the road, Athletic Greens takes the guesswork out of everyday good health. Why not just try it? Jump on over to athleticgreens.com/Rome. Claim my special offer right now. 20 free travel packs valued at $79 with your first purchase. That's athleticgreens.com/Rome. Remember on Thursday of last week when Nate Diaz took to social media to announce, quote, "You're all on steroids, not me." Remember that? And then he dropped a notes screenshot declaring that he would not be in New York this week for one of the fights of the year because, quote, "They say I tested with elevated levels that they say might be from some tainted supplements. I call false on that cause. I only take whole food or natural food supplements. I don't even eat meat," end quote. He then proceeded to call out everybody other than himself. Quote, "So until UFC, USADA, or whoever is bleeping with me fixes it, I won't be competing. I'm not going to play their game or try to hide it or keep quiet as they suggested. I'm not going to have my name tainted as a cheater like these other mother bleepers who keep quiet until after the fight just so they can get paid. Bleeping cheaters." End quote. So Nate was suggesting that the powers that be told him to keep his mouth shut, the whole thing would go away, and then you preserve the fight and he'd get paid. He said, "Oh, hell no. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't cheat. I'm not going to keep my mouth shut. I'm not like all the other mother bleepers." Well, now we know what happened. Turns out he tested positive for LGD 4033, which was found in an organic, plant-based, vegan multivitamin. And according to Kevin Ioli, quote, "The science director of USADA sent a letter to the New York State Athletic Commission in which he said the amount of LGD 4033 in Diaz's system was roughly 10,000 times less than one therapeutic dose," end quote. In other words, it actually was a contaminated supplement, and the contamination was so tiny it didn't even matter. So Nate was cleared. Nate was right. And the fight versus Jorge Masvidal is back on. So I'm guessing when Nate got that news, his reaction was similar to when he dropped this legendary line in the cage.
"How's that feel?" "Hey, I'm not surprised, motherfuckers."
So if you thought that that was going to make everything all right, that Nate got his name cleared and that he was good with that, you thought wrong. He put it another way.
"It's all just a big old bunch of bullshit.
It's just a big old bunch of bull bleep." Quote, "I thought it was all made up and a bunch of bull bleep. Anyway, it's behind us. Now we can move on." End of quote. Seems to me he's right and he's wrong. It was a bunch of bull bleep. Anyway, he's right about that. But somehow I doubt that this is behind us. It never is with Nate. At least I hope it never will be. I've said it before, I'll say it again. There is nobody like Nate Diaz. Time and time again, we've seen athletes come up with one explanation and one excuse after another when it comes to PEDs. or they deny that they've taken them. And then they turn out to be lying. Not Nate. Not Nate. He denied it, and he was right. The guy tweeted, quote, "You're all on steroids, not me." And he was right about that. And he had a few more things he wanted to say about the entire situation. Like about how when he first heard about the test results, he thought that everybody was messing with him. So he decided he was having none of that, and he swung back.
How about the fight? And let's let UFC and Masvidal and all these motherfuckers sweat, because I don't give a fuck about talking about steroids. You know what I'm saying? If you're on steroids, you don't want to talk about steroids. I've been around motherfuckers on steroids, and you start talking about steroids, they start looking the other directions and shit, you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. Man, I know what you're saying, and I love it. So Nate's like, I knew I didn't do anything wrong. Yeah, how about we just bleep off on this entire promotion? How about that? He said, I know guys who are on roids, and I know what happens when you're around guys who are on roids. When the topic comes up, they look the other way. They don't want to talk about it if you're on roids. So when they told me not to say anything, I wanted to talk about it. Because I'm not on roids, and this is about something more important than the money. Normally when somebody says it's not about the money, it's about one thing. The money. Except when Nate says it's not about the money, I believe Nate.
I don't care if it ruined your show. You ain't ruined my whole legacy. All I believe in the whole game is that, you know what I'm saying, I'm all natural. It's like if we was cavemen, I'd be the hardest caveman out there, you know what I'm saying?
Again, yes, Nate, I do know what you're saying. He just said, I don't care if I ruin your whole show. I don't care if I ruin your promotion. You're jerking with my legacy. You ain't ruining my whole legacy. All I believe in the whole game is that I'm all natural. If we were cavemen, I'd be the hardest caveman out there. Every time this guy opens his mouth, I like and respect him more. That is true, too, by the way. If they were all caveman, Nate would be the hardest caveman out there. And it gets better, because in addition to having his name tied to a failed test, Nate was pissed because he had to send all of his supplements to USADA. They wanted all of his supplements. As Dan Wetzel tweeted, quote, Nate Diaz now complaining that USADA, quote, stole $700, $800 in supplements from me, end quote. This was so USADA could test it to see if it caused elevated levels of a banned substance. It did. Quote, I had to go buy all new vitamins, end quote. Note, he'll make millions at UFC 244. So awesome. They made him send them his vitamins so they could test him. And Nate's response was, they stole money from me. They stole $700 from me. Again, he will make millions on this fight this weekend. And he's upset that they stole $700 from him. Nothing better than Nate complaining that he had to go out and buy a bunch of new supplements and that those supplements are expensive. So great. Never change, Nate. Never, ever change. And the best thing is he won't. And if you think that being cleared to fight on Saturday means that he's going to dial back anything, you could not be more wrong. He was also asked if USADA told him which supplement was the one that came back contaminated.
Yeah, but I don't believe him anyway. It's just a whole bunch of natural shit I use, and then, I don't know, conspiracy.
But stop right there. So he says, yes, they did tell me. But why would I believe them? They're trying to frame me anyway. Why would I believe anything they tell me, quote, it's a conspiracy? Look, I'm not sure what the conspiracy might be. Nate would argue that they're trying to keep him down and his brother. Nate would argue, I think, that they don't want anybody to get too big. So I'm not exactly sure what it is. Nate tries to spell it out, sort of. And he says it goes back to his interesting relationship with the UFC.
Every time after a fight, relationships change with the whole company. Every fight. Now, what if I win this fight? They can't have a real motherfucker after like me owning the whole being harder because too many people going to hear it. And I ain't trying to bust nobody out, but I feel like they need some type of leverage over me to keep me from being the king of the whole.
It's absolutely amazing. Look, I don't know what's true and what's not in that statement, but I'm thinking he might already be king of the bleep, king of the whole bleep. Nate's argument is they're kind of trying to keep him down because if he wins, they're not going to be able to handle a guy being as real as he is and being the king of the whole bleep. But I'm here to argue that he may already be king of the whole bleep. I do know this. When Nate Diaz walks away, we're all going to miss this guy because there will never be another guy like Nate Diaz. Why do you think I play all these sound bites? Because I've never had Nate Diaz on this show. And I can't say how badly I want to have him on this show. And now, despite all of that, we still have a fight. A really good fight. So he's going to get in the cage for the BMF title. Really the one that matters most. BMF. Baddest mother bleeper. Nate and Masvidal. And just in case you had forgotten about Masvidal, he was getting in a workout yesterday in Tim's. Check this picture out if you're watching on CBS Sports Network. My man's on the elliptical in Tim's versus the guy who tweeted, "You're all on steroids, not me." Saturday night, Madison Square Garden, one of them is walking away with the BMF belt. In fact, I'm going to be in New York Saturday night. What if I can get over there for that? Man, I'm so down for this. I don't care who he fights. I don't care where he fights. I don't care when he fights. Nate's got my money. I don't need to pay to see any event. I mean, I'm in the media, right? I just got to show up. I don't need to pay to see anything. But I'm going to go into my pocket to watch this guy fight every single time. In fact, I'd pay to see this guy do his shopping at Whole Foods. I'd pay to see this guy twist and burn blunts. I would pay to see this guy train for triathlons. Just put a camera on Nate. Follow Nate around all day long. And then tell me how much I owe you. Never mind fighting. Dude should stream his genius 24/7. I'm in. Nathan freaking Diaz, if you need him. All of that, that entire long form rant, and I didn't even get into the fight itself because Nate's been so amazing outside the cage. So who you got, clones? Nathan or Jorge? West Coast or East Coast gangster? That's not me, that's them. That's how they bill it. The baddest West Coast gangster against the baddest East Coast gangster. Who you got? This has the makings of an awesome toe-to-toe entertaining brawl. Masvidal is a bad, bad cat. He is a bad dude with some serious knockout power. A legitimate street fighter against Nate. A dude who complains about fighters who do not come forward. Now, Nate has fought as a welterweight at times, but Masvidal lives there. So you think that might be an advantage. Odds makers like Masvidal. But then again, we're on a big stage. A really big stage. Nate has been on that big stage. Nate's come through on that stage. Nate's been in the spotlight against Conor twice. He hounded it like a boss. Jorge never has. So, can Masvidal handle that? I got a better question. Can Masvidal handle this? Because when you get Nate, you get... That's what comes along with it. You get Nate, you get his unbelievable ground game, you get his fighting genius, and you get... Can you see that coming, Masvidal? Do you care that this is coming? We're going to find out Saturday night in the Mecca who really is the baddest mother bleeper. I cannot wait. Can't wait. Have some. Have some more. It's going to be so good. So glad that fight's back on. Even if it was never off. Who you got? Nate or Masvidal? Tom Verducci is going to be part of Fox's World Series broadcast of Game 6 tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, plus MLB Network's MLB Tonight, which is airing live before and after the game. He joins us once again. Tom, it is great to have you back. Thanks so much for doing it. How are you?
I am great. It's always cool when you get a chance to go to the ballpark and the World Series championship will be on the line.
That is the best. All right, so before we get into tonight's game, if you were to go back Friday to Friday, Tom, before Game 3, the Astros were on the road. They were down 2-0. They were not looking anything like themselves in the first two games. In fact, what did you make of how they showed up in those first two games?
Surprise. I knew the Nationals came in obviously red hot. I thought maybe the off days would have affected the Nationals more than it did. But Houston really surprised me how they were off their game in the first couple of games, especially Cole and Verlander losing back-to-back for the first time all year. But even that, the quality of their bats weren't great. Remember, this is a team that led the major leagues in the fewest strikeouts and the most walks. That has never been done before. It's an incredible combination. And it wasn't until Game 3 that that team showed up.
All right, so then in Game 3, a game where the Astros used six pitchers and they allowed just one run, as you wrote, A.J. Hinch lined up the game so that Washington's 1-4 hitters saw only Zach Greinke and only his two best relievers. How significant then was A.J. Hinch in that game?
Yeah, I mean, huge. Listen, he went with Greinke and got him out there in that, I thought, pivotal inning there. He brought in Josh James to pitch to Ryan Zimmerman, two guys on base. Nationals Park was going nuts. He was able to navigate his way through that. I think he saw that Greinke just actually throughout the postseason hasn't been the same Greinke in terms of command. But then, yeah, he pushes Will Harris, who I think has been his best reliever, Roberto Osuna, the closer, into a game early because that's when the middle of the order was coming up, right? That's what I'm talking about with the way he managed these games. And I think he's been much more pedal to the metal than Davey Martinez, who's kind of saving his games for spots that never come around and games get away. And clearly Hinch has made it a priority here that any kind of a situation, and it doesn't have to be the eighth inning, if it's Rendon and Soto coming up, he wants Will Harris on them. If it's the ninth inning, obviously it's Osuna. And that plan has worked out perfectly so far.
Tom Verducci is joining us before Game 6. All right, then what about Game 4? Jose Urquidy, who never pitched above Class A before this year, turns in five great innings. Meanwhile, as you wrote, the Astros approached Patrick Corbin like it was an American Legion game. How much do the Astros hitters know about Corbin before that game, or how much did they know?
You know, not a whole lot. I talked to Jose Altuve about that. Last time he saw him was 2017. Corbin obviously is one of the best sliders in the game. He wants to get you out by chasing that slider out of the zone, and it's all set up with a fastball to get to a two-strike count. And I just got a kick out of early that as Corbin was warming up before the first inning, Springer's out there. Yeah, he's the leadoff batter. He should be out there. But Altuve and Bregman are out there. Not just in front of the dugout, they're on the grass close to the circle of home plate, and you can see them just timing the pitches of Patrick Corbin. And they get in the box, and both of those guys got first pitch fastballs, and both of those guys squared it up for base hits. And that's when they went four singles in a row, took the lead. Essentially, as Altuve told me, that was pretty much the game there with a lead. So, listen, this team is so smart besides being talented. I think when you look at hitters like Altuve and Bregman especially, they're just so smart, and they understand what pitchers are trying to do to them. They're a great breaking ball hitting team. They are the best breaking ball hitting team in all of baseball, and that is proven in the course of this series. Yeah, they're good, but they're super smart hitters.
We are talking to Tom Verducci. So, Tom, things were going so well for the Nationals. They come back home. They lose three in a row. I mean, pretty disastrous. I don't think anybody needs a reminder of how tough this Nationals team is from a mental and psychological standpoint, right? We saw what they overcame this year. We saw how far they've come. But how rough a weekend was that for them, and how do you think they do show up tonight?
Yeah, that's a great point because, listen, you're talking about a city there, the district, that hadn't seen a World Series game in, what, 86 years or whatever it was. And it finally comes to Washington. Not only did they not win a game, they never had a lead in the series at home, those three games. It was just crazy that they didn't have a reason to get involved in these games, and the Astros would jump out early with home runs or, in one case, the four singles. It took the crowd out of the game. It's like, you know, you showed up at a party and they said, well, tonight we're just going to go with drill. The hard stuff is not going to be here. It's like, okay, we'll do the best that we can. And I really felt bad for the city of Washington that the games weren't more competitive, at least going back and forth a little bit. But, yeah, you mentioned their toughness, Jim. That's not in question. This team has played three games so far in the postseason where it's win or go home. And guess what? They've won them all. They won the wild card game with a comeback late in the game. They won two games against the Dodgers, games four and game five, backs against the wall. They've got Steven Strasburg on the mound. They haven't lost a game with him on the mound in the postseason. I think the Nationals are looking at this like they're not in a terrible situation here in Game 6 because of Strasburg. And because, yeah, they've won these elimination games before three times.
And then you get it to game seven where anything can happen. And why wouldn't you like your chances with Strasburg, except for the fact that he's got to go up against Justin Verlander, Tom Verducci, my guest, for a few more moments. Tom, like Verlander, he's done absolutely everything there is to do as a pitcher, which, except for win a World Series game, which is really kind of strange and bizarre. Knowing this guy as the ultimate competitor, this lack of a World Series win is not for a lack of trying. And as you point out, he is not looking to join Kevin Brown and Schoolboy Rowe as the only guys to lose three potential postseason clinchers. What do you think it would mean to him to get the win tonight that wins the World Series for Houston?
Yeah, this means a lot to him. Justin, as you mentioned, ultimate competitor. He knows baseball history. Like, he knows where he is on the strikeout list and win list and what's ahead of him down the road milestone-wise. It's part of what drives him. Yes, him. But he's one of these guys. He does have a sense of baseball history, and he knows there's a big fat zero in the one-loss column in the World Series in his record. Now, he hasn't pitched badly in the World Series, Jim. Six games there. While he's been in the game, his teams have scored a total of seven runs. Right? They've never scored more than two runs while he's been on the mound in those five, six World Series games. So it's not like he's been terrible, but again, he knows what the history of this thing is, and especially now getting the ball, you know, to try to close out the World Series. That means even more to him. I think the whole key for him, Jim, is going to be whether he has a slider or not. And, you know, that slider, to me, is one of the best sliders in the game. It was during the regular season. Batters hit .119 off a slider. That's ridiculous. Postseason, it's gone missing a little bit. They're hitting about .235, which is really high. He changed his grip the last start. I thought it was a little bit better. You know, the Nationals have been beaten in this series because the Houston Astros have really increased the amount of breaking ball pitches they've thrown. You know, the Nationals went 0-14 against Gerrit Cole against breaking pitches in Game 5. You know, we all know about the fastball. That was his best breaking ball game of his career, 0-14, Gerrit Cole. So Verlander's got to go out there. He needs to beat them, at least put them away. You can get ahead with fastballs, but you need to put the Nationals away with breaking balls. He's got a good curveball, but to me that slider is going to be the key. If you see him get some outs early in the game with the slider, that to me would be good news for the Houston Astros.
Tom Verducci is my guest. That's an amazing stat you had about Gerrit Cole. I think it speaks to exactly how good this guy is and his ability to adjust. So if it comes down to, or to a large extent, whether or not Verlander's got that slider tonight, Tom, what's your gut tell you? Before I ask you about what could happen in a Game 7, do you think there's going to be a Game 7?
I do think there's going to be a Game 7 because I've just seen a lot of Steven Strasburg this postseason. And nothing's bothering this guy. I think the quality of his stuff is amazing. I think he's such a difficult task for those Houston hitters to solve because he's got four pitches that he throws, and he throws them almost exactly an equal amount of time. And if you watched him pitch in that, what was it, Game 2, and he pitched against the Astros, he got the six full counts, and five of those were breaking balls or changeups. So he's not afraid to throw any pitch at any time. And I think right now, if you ask me to break down these two pitchers going tonight on pure stuff, it's Edge Washington. And we know so far in this World Series, home field advantage has meant absolutely nothing. Home team hasn't won a game yet. So to me, I think the Nationals can find a way behind Strasburg to win this game. They have to go Strasburg straight to Doolittle and Hudson. Maybe there's an at-bat there for Patrick Corbin to get it, Alvarez. But you're going to be a very short bullpen in terms of who Davey Martinez trusts in this game.
Tom, so as a quick follow, if in fact it goes that way, what can Martinez expect, if anything, from Max Scherzer in Game 7? What's your sense?
Yeah, that's the ultimate question. My sense is not much. You know, if Max is physically able to get on the mound, I mean, he couldn't even lift his arm the other day. So that wasn't even a question of whether he could or couldn't pitch. I just think this thing is a little more serious than a lot of people think. It's not like waking up with, you know, a stiff neck and you get some heat treatment, you get a cortisone shot and you're good to go. There's a nerve problem in there with Max on the trapezoid neck area. And listen, they're going to say, they'll find out today how much better it's improved with the cortisone shot. Listen, again, if he can lift his arm, he's going to try to pitch. What they can get out of him, I don't know. But as you know, Jim, you get to a Game 7, man, it's anything can happen. It's all hands on deck. All the rules of engagement of how you play a baseball game go out the window. It's do anything to win one baseball game. So I couldn't even tell you if anybody would have an advantage in that game with or without Max Scherzer.
Trade pros, whether you specialize in service or new construction, Ferguson knows firsthand how much work goes into a hard day's work. That's why they're committed to offering the products and solutions that you need to get the job done right the first time, every time. With expert associates at more than 1,000 locations across the country and an unmatched selection of products, tools, and supplies, as well as same or next day delivery and their time-saving pro pickup service, you can trust that doing business with Ferguson will be the easiest part of your day. Remember, for projects and teams of any size and any scope, Ferguson has a winning game plan for contractors like you. So when the pressure is on, you can count on Ferguson. Visit Ferguson.com and find a location near you. Go to Ferguson.com. All right, so you got World Series Game 6. Let me get ahead of Tom Verducci because I've got nothing to add that he won't have already. He's Tom Verducci. So you got a huge game tonight for both teams, but especially Houston, and especially Justin Verlander. Like, Justin Verlander is a first-ballot Hall of Famer. Amazing player. Not a lot of dudes get a chance, though, to work the bump and wrap up a championship at the age of 36. He's already got one. But given the narrative surrounding how he's pitched in the World Series, this is a really important game for him. Really important game for him. So a huge night for him, huge night for the Astros, huge night for everybody there. And obviously the biggest night in the history of the Nats franchise, because if they can somehow stop the bleeding and get this thing to an all-hands-on-deck Game 7, then anything can happen, because generally it does. But you can't get to a Game 7 without pulling the upset and winning a Game 6, a Game 6 that Vegas expects Houston to take. But tonight's game is not just about the dudes between the chalk. It's also very much about the fans behind the dish, because those premium seats have become a hotbed for content and controversy throughout the entire postseason. In this postseason alone, we have seen Russ in the beard nearly die of apathy and boredom during an extremely dramatic elimination game in the ALCS. We've also seen some dude at Yankee Stadium stand up, pull up his sweater, and reveal a Joe Buck sucks tee. Right in the front row for the entire world to see, and a tip of the hat to Joe Buck, who rolled with it and made light of it, because he knows. Joe Buck, to me, is like one of those examples of people like Twitter unilaterally, or somebody unilaterally decides, that guy. I hate that guy. I hate that guy. And then because so many others have nothing better to do, they just rush in to hate that guy too, without really having a reason to hate that guy other than they've got nothing to do. And I'm not going to tell you how to feel about Joe Buck. I can just tell you Joe Buck is a really professional play-by-play guy who can do a number of sports. But no matter what he does going forward, no matter what kind of work he does, and I think he does exceptional work, honestly, people will hate him and show up in the front row with shirts that say, Joe Buck sucks. So better off to roll with it, and he does. And then two nights ago in the district, three Instagram models from the online publication ShagMag also lifted up their clothing, but not to show a Joe Buck sucks tee, but rather to show no message at all. In fact, not only was there no message, there was nothing at all. They just lifted up their shirts to lift up their shirts to completely expose their breasts. On broadcast, rabbit ear, network, television. Over the air, network, rabbit ear, television. So in a time when everybody's got a podcast, everybody's got a blog, everybody has a brand, it takes a whole lot to get noticed. These three gals from the previously unknown ShagMag flashed millions of viewers at home, and that got them noticed. And if the surprise nudity did not do the trick, the ensuing lifetime ban from baseball sure as hell did.
For life.
Move over, my man. Peter Edward Rose, you've got yourself some company. The three ladies in question told TMZ yesterday that their goal was to raise awareness for breast cancer during Breast Cancer Awareness Month and to promote their brand. They also pointed out there's a very obvious double standard. Men can expose their bare chests with no consequence at all.
it just is a total double standard, and that's part of our mission statement. You know, we're a men's magazine. We love men's entertainment. We love sex, sex articles, sex tips, all that. And at the same time, we love pushing the boundaries and being like, yo, this is a double standard, and how can we, in a playful way, because we think it's playful, kind of change this?
Yo. Yo, like, there's a double standard. In a playful way. Playful, pornographic, whatever. Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, I guess, if you look at it on the surface, I guess what they're saying could be accurate. I guess there is a double standard. We can take off our shirts at a baseball game. Nothing happens. They do it. They get banned for life. I guess. For life. Yeah, like, I don't know. Maybe the solution here is just to make sure that nobody takes off their shirt inside a stadium. I mean, can't we all agree that the world would be a better place if the likes of, well, if women kept their shirts on and Keith Arnold kept his on too, so he's not allowed to flash his pepperoni nips all over the joint?
I don't even have big nipples. Like, let's be real.
Yo, Batman. Batman! What's good? What's good, Batman? What's good, Keith? What's good, pepperoni nips? Hey, Batman, I got pepperoni for you. Anyway, there is now a lifetime banishment from baseball. I mean, good luck enforcing that. I'm pretty sure these three ladies are going to have very little problem getting into another ballpark. What are you going to do? Put up nude pictures of them at every turnstile across the country? And even then, really, do you really want to spend the next 50 years enforcing that? You're going to tell me these three, when they're 90, are still not going to be let in to do what they want to do at a baseball game? You're going to go out Frank the Tank with them?
We're going streaking! Yeah!
So I guess in a way, what's really amazing about this is you've got Game 5, and the most memorable thing from Game 5 were four different chests. The three bare ones behind home plate and the fully clothed one in center field that took a direct Yordan Alvarez dinger. Well, double fisting. A couple of tall boys.
2-1. That is hit into left center field. Back at the wall. It is gone. Yordan Alvarez back in the lineup for the Astros, and he goes deep the opposite way to make it 2-0 Houston in the second.
I think he had a beer in each hand, and he just let it hit him right in the chest or the gut.
Not one drop spilled. I mean, that's next level.
That was next level. So tonight, while Verlander looks to cement his World Series legacy, the Nats look to survive and force a Game 7. You can fully expect the camera crew from Fox to be on high alert for any potential copycat flashers. No shoes, no shirt, no baseball. Jared Bednar is my guest. Jared, it's good to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Jim.
Good. Good to have you. So you're coming off back-to-backs where you beat Vegas and then drop one to Anaheim. When you lose a game like that and then you've got a few days off, is that a good thing, or would you rather get back out there as quickly as you can and get that taste out of your mouth?
It just depends on the situation. I think in this one it was good to get a couple days off. We had gone on a long Eastern road trip and then snuck home for a day or two and then went to Vegas. To finish that off with the back-to-back, I think our guys needed a little bit of rest, and we're just starting to battle a few injuries too. So to get a mental break away from the rink for a couple days and get off the ice and get rested, I think is a good thing for us.
All right, so you're 11 games into the season. Nathan MacKinnon has a point in every single game. Despite that really, really good start, he says he still has areas where he thinks he can improve. What do you make of the way he's shown up at the start of the season, and how do you think he's playing?
Well, he's playing good. I mean, if you see the way Nathan trains in the summertime and the condition he comes back to training camp in, it's not surprising that he's out to a hot start. I know that he, you know, we and he expect a lot from himself. So, you know, to be able to be on an 11-game point streak and still feel like you're not playing your best is pretty remarkable. And it just kind of shows you what a world-class athlete he is. And so, you know, these next few games with some of the injuries that we have are going to be real important, and he's certainly going to start carrying an even bigger load than he already has.
Yeah, I was going to say, so what makes him special? Is it that world-class talent, or is it something else, something more intangible?
I think it's both. Like, certainly his skating ability and his talent is they're exceptional. But I believe that the difference that kind of pushes him over the top is his drive and his competitiveness. I mean, this guy is a competitor in everything he does, and he wants to win so bad that he drives our team in that direction. And when you mix both of those, the talent and speed, and then that drive, I think was what makes the elite guys super elite.
Jared Bednar is my guest. You know, part of the reason I want to talk to you is your journey to this point is so interesting. You came up, you played in the ECHL, the IHL, the AHL. So how would you describe yourself as a player?
I was a mucker and grinder. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't have the talent, I guess, to be able to play in the NHL. So, and even in the American League and International League level, I was one of those borderline guys, like a character guy that just tried to do whatever I could to help the team win. And, you know, when you get in those situations, you have to really pay attention to all the, you know, what the coaches want as far as structure and the way you want to play, and you got to try and chip in any little way you can. So I think that's what kind of helped steer me towards the coaching side of it. As I got a little further along in my career playing in the minors, I decided that was an avenue that I wanted to pursue. And so it's you know, very similar. I started in the ECHL as a coach and then went to the American League and spent a number of years in each league before I ended up getting the opportunity in Colorado. Now I'm just trying to make the most of it and try to lead our team to win some hockey games here and get into the playoffs and get a chance to go after that cup.
You see, that's the thing. I mean, you were going to go all in. Once you decide to be a coach, you were going to go all in and you wanted to coach in the NHL and win a Stanley Cup, but that meant that you were going to have to move around quite a bit. Growing up, you were the son of a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer, which meant that you moved around as a kid, and that's not something you necessarily wanted for your family. So family and friends are important to you. What was it like then when you and your wife decided the family would stay in South Carolina while you pursued coaching? How challenging a decision was that to make?
Well, that was a tough one. Yeah, that was a tough one. You know, like you said, growing up, I moved every, you know, 3 to 4 years. You're on the move a lot, and I think there's a lot of positives you take out of that. You get to, you know, meet new people and see new places, and we were lucky enough to get stationed at the same place a couple times and reconnect with friends. But when I sort of settled in Charleston, South Carolina, I was playing for the Stingrays and coaching for the Stingrays hockey team there. What happens is that you see your kids kind of get dug in their sports and you don't want to move them around. Plus, I didn't know how long I was going to be in these different cities because my contracts weren't really long-term. So we decided to sort of, you know, me to go on and pursue that and come back in the summer. And my wife and kids came out every chance they could, and I went home whenever I could in breaks in the season. But it's tough, you know, missing your kids grow up and seeing their events and the sports and everything that they do on a nightly basis. But, you know, there was a lot of Skype and phone calls, and it's worked out, you know. To be able to get to the NHL and now have them here with me, I think, is very special, and I'm trying to get them to enjoy it as much as I am.
Good night now!